This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Nick Cave, is famous for his dark songs and for his rough voice, which brings out all the dark colors of those songs. In an article about him in Entertainment Weekly, Chris Nashawaty described Cave as first becoming known for raw live shows that set a punishing new standard for self-destructive mayhem, then developing into a sort of doomed Weimar cabaret crooner in a black Undertaker suit. Nashawaty writes, quote, "Over the years, Cave's songwriting has become more intricate and challenging, almost literary in its ambitions. He's one of the few artists in rock and roll who's managed to get better with age," unquote. Cave grew up in Australia and now lives in England. He wrote the screenplay for the bloody western The Proposition and co-wrote the scores for that film and the 2007 film The Assassination of Jesse James by the coward Robert Ford. Nick Cave's new album with his band The Bad Seeds is called Dig Lazarus Dig. Here's the title track.
Larry made his nest up in the autumn branches, built from nothing but high hopes and thin air. He collected up some baby blasted mothers. They took their chances, and for a while they lived quite happily up there. He came from New York City, man, but he couldn't take the pace, and thought it was like a dog-eat-dog world. But he went to San Francisco, spent a year in outer space with a sweet little San Franciscan girl. I can hear my mother wailing and a whole lot of scraping of chairs. I don't know what it is, but there's definitely something going on upstairs.
Nick Cave, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell me the story behind writing that song. What made you think about writing a song that refers to Lazarus?
I think I was getting some kind of revenge on my religious upbringing. I was particularly, as a child, it worried me a lot, that particular story, that Christ's greatest miracle was actually bringing someone back from the dead. And that kind of, as a child, creeped me out somewhat, to be honest. It didn't exactly traumatize me, but it felt kind of nice to sort of redress that in some kind of way and write a song about it. So I basically took the biblical Lazarus and dropped him in New York City and kind of a half comical look at what would happen to him in the contemporary world.
You said that you see the song as revenge for your religious upbringing. So many of your songs refer, you know, have biblical references or references to Jesus or God, and some in a more straightforward way, some in a more elliptical way, some in a comic way, some in a cynical way, some in a searching or loving way. Was that always true of your songs, or is this something more recent?
I think it was always true. I can remember as very young writing poetry, and the stories from the Bible always played a you know, there was always a strong element of that, even in my very, very early poetry, which I'm not going to
recite for us
recite
now
on radio. But there was a kind of fascination. There was a fascination when I was, you know, I was a choir boy at school and at the cathedral that I went to, and I had to go to church maybe three times a week for about 3 or 4 years, and I was actually kind of interested. Especially in the biblical stories.
How old were you when you started reading the Bible?
I kind of got into the Bible because I went to art school and became very interested in religious painting. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that was because I understood the stories. I knew what those paintings were about, and I took a great interest in them. And then I think after that I started to kind of read, particularly the Old Testament, a lot. And I did that for quite a few years, and that had a huge influence over the way I saw the world, really, and also the songs that I wrote at that time. you know. And then I kind of gave that up and looked at the New Testament after a while.
So what are the differences?
But it's one. It's only kind of one element of what I'm doing, really.
But what's the difference between your Old Testament and your New Testament songs?
Well, I think that there's a kind of more humanistic approach to the characters in my songs, more a forgiving approach to the narratives.
Well, I want to play another track from your new CD, Dig Lazarus Dig, and this one also has a Jesus reference to it. It's called Jesus of the Moon. It's a beautiful song. I mean, it's a love song. Would you talk a little bit about writing this song?
Well, you know, I mean, I think that this particular record, Dig Lazarus Dig, despite the title, is probably the least obsessed or religiously obsessed record I made in years. It's really not about that. And there is a song called Jesus of the Moon, really, but I just felt it was a kind of nifty way of describing a sleeping woman and a sleeping woman that I was kind of departing from. It just felt good to describe her in that way. But it's I guess the reason why it's on the record, this particular song, even though it's not really a ballad record, and this is very much a ballad, is that it felt like, to me, a kind of fresh take for me on the leaving a woman type of song that I often write. There seemed to be a kind of rebirth in the whole thing that sounded kind of nice to me.
Oh, I think it's a great song. Let's hear it. This is Jesus of the Moon from Nick Cave's new CD, which is called Dig Lazarus Dig.
I stepped out of the St. James Hotel. I left you behind, curled up like a child. Change is gonna come. The door whispered shut. I walked on down the high-windowed hall. You lay sleeping on the unmade bed. The weatherman on the television in the St. James Hotel said that the rains are gonna come. And I stepped out on the street, all sparkling clean with the early morning dew. Maybe it was you and maybe it was me. You came on like a punch in the heart. You lying there with the light on your hair, like a Jesus of the moon, a Jesus of the planets and the stars.
That's Nick Cave's song, Jesus of the Moon, from his new CD, Dig Lazarus Dig. You said that this was your least biblically obsessed record, in spite of the fact that we've heard two Bible or Jesus-related songs. But there's also a song on here called We Call Upon the Author to Explain. That's kind of like, you know, asking God to explain why life and the earth are such a mess.
Yeah, well, it is. You're kind of choosing three songs, really, that deal with that sort of thing, but the rest of the stuff doesn't, although I'm sure you're going to pull out another song and say, oh, hang on about that song. But it actually felt to me while I was writing it that I was onto something different.
Mm-hmm,
it
mm-hmm.
really felt, and it took me a lot of time to get there. Usually I can spend a few weeks in the office where I write, kind of anguishing over things, and I kind of get this out of my system and find something new to write about. This took a long time. This record took a long time to write and to find something new to talk about and a new way of using words, which I'm always kind of searching for. So I felt that it was very much a departure. But I guess at the same time, I have certain themes that I always come back to, and I guess I try and look at them from different, you know, vantage points.
Now, you also have another band called Grinder Man, and you had a Grinder Man CD in 2007. What's the difference to you between the Bad Seeds and Grinder Man?
Well, I guess the Bad Seeds are kind of like the mothership or something like that. And, you know, we're on our, I don't know, 14th album or something like that. And to continue to make records like that, you have to find ways to exist and ways to exist in a credible way without just kind of repeating yourself all the time. And I think Grinder Man to me was, for me at least, was a way to write new and different sorts of songs with a reduced lineup. The Bad Seeds, there's eight, maybe nine people in the Bad Seeds. and in Grinder Man there's four, and I was able to write different songs and record different songs with that, even though it's the same four of the same people of the Bad Seeds. And now it feels like Grinder Man kind of go out places where, you know, and kind of find things out and sort of deliver them back to the mothership, which is the Bad Seeds. And the Grinder Man record, I think, had a huge influence over this new record.
So what do you feel like you brought back from the Grinder Man CD to the Bad Seeds?
Well, it's much sparser, and there's much more space and room around the instruments. It's also a lot looser. It's largely first take kind of stuff that you're hearing. It's much more improvised, more experimental with the actual sounds that are being used.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When we went in to do the new record, I deliberately kind of made it kind of difficult for the band, in that I took away the instruments that they normally play, and they played other instruments. Mick Harvey didn't play electric guitar, but played acoustic guitar. Warren, who traditionally has played the violin, didn't bring his violin to the studio. There was no piano, which is a huge change for the Bad Seeds. I mean, very little piano.
And that's your instrument.
And that is my instrument, yeah. So I was kind of playing organ. No matter what we did, it had to sort of sound different because of that.
You're playing electric guitar on this too, right?
Yeah, I do a bit, yeah.
Well, so let me play a track, and it's a track whose track itself we can play, but the title we can't say on the air, so I'll euphemize it a little and call it Not Getting Any Blues. Would that work for you?
Well, I think I said it better, but I'll let that go.
Yes, you did, and we can't say it. But we can play it because the title isn't in the track, at least not what we're going to hear. So this is a really very funny song, and I just wanted to show that side of you. So anything you want to say about writing it?
Well, I came up with the title.
Which we can't say.
Which we can't say. But, a lot of the Grinder Man stuff is kind of ad-libbed, lyrically ad-libbed as well, and it's lyrically much looser. And it's, you know, it's four guys in a studio for 5 days with very little sleep, and I guess the kind of humorous, there's a certain sense of hysteria about the kind of recording process, and that comes through with some of those lyrics, I think.
Okay, so this is Nick Cave from the Grinder Man CD, and he's featured on voice and guitar.
I saw a girl in the crowd, I ran over, I shouted out, I asked her if I could take her out, but she said that she didn't want to. I changed the sheets on my bed, I combed the hairs across my head, I sucked in my gut, and still she said that she just didn't want to. I read her Yeats, I tried best to stay up late, I fixed the hinges on her gate, but still she just never wanted to. I bought her a dozen snow white doves, I did her dishes in rubber gloves, I called her honeybee, I called her love, but she just still didn't want to. She just never wants to.
That's Nick Cave's band Grinder Man, and that's Nick Cave playing electric guitar. What does it feel like to play that kind of distortion? It must feel great. I mean, it must feel like a real release. Would you describe what it feels like?
Well, the guitar is something you kind of embrace, and the piano is something you kind of, when you play it, you sort of push it away. It feels very different, and as a guitarist in Grinder Man, I feel much more involved in the making of the music than I do as a piano player. I don't really know how to describe that, but piano is, for the way I play it, is really about melody, and you know, it just feels very different. And it's you've kind of got the history of rock and roll in your hands with a guitar. you know, it suddenly I was like, oh, that's why rock and roll is the way it is.
You live in England now, but you grew up in Australia. Would you describe the town you grew up in?
It's called Wangaratta. I mean, it's about 18,000 people, and it was, but with very much a kind of small town mentality. And to be honest, I was quite happy to get out of there.
Because?
Well, it was very restrictive, and all the stuff that I find difficult with Australia is amplified a thousandfold in these small towns. And that's if you kind of stick your head too high above the parapet, it gets lopped off, if you understand what I mean. Everyone has to be kind of the same, you know, and hunker down. And I wasn't kind of interested in that. So it was quite difficult for me. It was quite difficult for my family in general, actually.
It was hard for me to imagine you fitting into a place like that.
Well, I didn't. And I got sent to Melbourne when I was about 12. It just wasn't working out in this town for me.
I got sent to
a boarding school in Melbourne.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And was that's a more metropolitan place?
Well, a more metropolitan place. I mean, that also had its problems as well. But there's a lot about the growing up in the country that I loved, especially as a child, and my childhood was spent, you know, down by the river and all of that sort of stuff, and it was very free and very happy, actually. But as a teenager, you know, around that time in Wangaratta, it was very difficult.
Did you have access, either in Wangaratta or in Melbourne, to the movies and music and books that eventually meant a lot to you?
Well, I did. You know, I mean, when I was 9 or 10, we got the Johnny Cash show, for example, in Australia. That was shown in Australia mm-hmm. on a weekly basis. So I watched that, and that had a huge impact on me. My brother, who was 4 years older, was very into music and listened to a lot of kind of great music. And so I was very much influenced by what he listened to. A lot of English progressive music, you know. So, you know, I was around music a lot.
What impact did Johnny Cash have on you?
Well, I remember distinctly watching the Johnny Cash show and my ideas about what music could be changing. You know, the gears kind of shifted, and something happened with the whole chemistry. My whole chemistry kind of changed watching that. There was something that I didn't really understand then, I guess, but that was so kind of edgy about that particular show.
And Johnny Cash himself, you know, in addition to his just incredibly moving voice, he was able to sing both about the spiritual and do really convincing murder ballads and revenge ballads.
Yeah, I mean, the way I looked at him when I was young was that he was an outlaw. You know, I'm talking about a young boy who was 9 or 10 watching this kind of stuff. But he seemed like that. It seemed like that rock and roll or music could be an outlaw kind of thing that operated on the periphery of society in some way. I've now since watched those shows on DVD, actually, recently, the Johnny Cash shows, and they're extraordinary.
Did Johnny Cash in a way help point the direction for you to music that both had a really dark and a really spiritual component?
I think absolutely. You know, I mean, the records that I had before that were the Tijuana, Herb Albert Tijuana Brass records. And I bought one of them, and then I went out and bought another one. So they were the first two records I ever bought.
That's really
and
funny.
You know, but I didn't know, you know, I was in this country town, and there was something about that kind of music that I liked. But Johnny Cash kind of changed all that.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with songwriter and singer Nick Cave. He has a new album with his band, The Bad Seeds. He writes dark literary songs, many of which have been inspired by stories in the Old and New Testaments. In spite of the title of his new album, Dig Lazarus Dig, Cave describes it as the least biblical of his recent CDs. His music is sometimes intentionally discordant, especially when he plays with his other band, Grinder Man. Here's another side of him. He's featured on piano and vocals on this track from his 1997 CD, The Boatman's Call.
I don't believe in an interventionist God. But I know, darling, that you do. But if I did, I would kneel down and ask him not to intervene when it came to you. Well, not to touch a hair in your head, leave you as you are. If he felt he had to direct you, then direct you into my arms. Into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms,
oh Lord. We were talking before about how, you know, you grew up in Australia in a small rural town, ended up having real problems. You were sent to a boarding school. You had been in the choir, in the church choir, and then ended up, of course, in a band. When you started performing, did you create a stage persona for yourself? Did you kind of refashion yourself to be Nick Cave, the performer?
No, I don't think I did that consciously. But the thing about performing for me, I feel very much that I can be that person I always wanted to be. And there's something that's still very much about that to me. When I go on stage and I'm involved in the music and I hear the band playing and lose myself in the songs, I do lose myself and go to some other place. And it's and I feel that I become someone different. I don't think that it's a persona as so much as I'm kind of lifted up to be the kind of person that I'd always wanted to be.
And who is that person compared to the person you think?
Well, it's kind of godlike, you know. It's not that ordinary person. And you go off stage and then suddenly you're that ordinary person again, you know. I mean, I remember that from far back as I can remember, really. But especially as a young boy, you know, I would listen to music and I'd pretend I was singing it, and I would imagine being on stage and singing this stuff to the crowds and all of that kind of thing, you know, and I would go into this other world, this alternate world. But I'm the way of kind of rock person should be, which is kind of half cartoon character, you know. It's kind of necessary. We should be seen from afar, you know, and be able to be drawn in broad strokes. And I think I've kind of managed that.
I don't want to dwell on this at all, but I do have a musical-related question about it. I know that earlier in your life you shot heroin. And did that affect your sense of who you were on or off stage? Did it help you in its own way be the person you wanted to be or not?
I really don't know. I don't know what effect that had. It lasted a really long time. I mean, I was involved in that for a really long time. But it was very convenient and it was very helpful. But in the end, kind of destructive enough for me to stop it, you know.
It must have been hard to stop because it took a long time.
It was hard. I mean, it wasn't hard. Once I decided I'd stop, it was actually quite easy.
Would you be willing to talk about why you decided to stop?
Well, the problem was getting to that point where I wanted to stop, you know.
Mm-hmm. Was it in a way like waking up from a long sleep to be out of the influence of the drug?
Well, I don't really see it in that way, you know. I never saw it as a bad thing. It just became impractical. I don't have a kind of moral issue with drug taking at all. I just, I couldn't work anymore, basically. I couldn't work and I couldn't perform basic functions properly. I certainly couldn't have a relationship. you know, or that worked in any kind of way. So it was necessary to give it up.
Now, we talked a little earlier about growing up in Australia, and one of the things about Australia is that, you know, the white people there basically came to start a penal colony. And you wrote the screenplay for the film The Proposition, which relates to that. And you wrote the score. You co-wrote the score for it, too. So we're going to hear the title clip, so to speak, the title scene in which the police captain actually makes the proposition. But set the scene for us. This is very early on in the film. Just summarize for us what's brought us to this point.
Well, the film opens with the kind of obliteration of the Burns gang by the police in a horrible kind of gunfight. And the two brothers, there's three brothers, but two of them have been captured. Mikey, which is the little one, and Charlie, which is the main character of the film. And the police chief presents these two brothers with a proposition in regard to Arthur Burns, a kind of renegade brother who has departed from the gang some time before and is living up in the hills. And what you will hear now is the proposition.
I wish to present you with a proposition. I know where Arthur Burns is. It is a godforsaken place. The blacks won't go there, not the trackers, not even my own men. I suppose in time the bounty hunters will get him. But I have other plans. I aim to bring him down. I aim to show that he is a man like any other. I aim to hurt him.
When you're ready, sir.
And what will most hurt him? Well, I thought long and hard about that. And I've realized, Mr. Burns, that I must become a little more inventive in my methods. Now, don't speak, Mr. Burns. Listen to me now. Don't say a word. I suppose I told you there was a way to save your little brother, Mikey, from the noose. Suppose I gave you a horse and a gun. Suppose, Mr. Burns, I was to give both you and your young brother Mikey here a pardon.
Suppose I said that I could give you the chance to expunge the guilt beneath which you so clearly labor. Suppose I gave you till Christmas. I suppose you tell me what it is I want from you.
You want me to kill me, brother?
I want you to kill your brother.
Arthur Burns is a monster. An abomination. You were right to part company with him.
It's Ray Winstone in a scene from The Proposition, which was written by my guest Nick Cave, who also co-wrote the score. That must be pretty exciting to write the screenplay and the music for a movie. It's a very brutal film and again relates to the origins of Australia as a penal colony. Since you are interested in like murder ballads and revenge and songs about those themes, are you particularly interested in the penal colony origins of your country of origin?
I mean, we all are. All Australians are, to a degree. I mean, for a long time we were, as a country, it was considered a kind of shameful aspect to our heritage. You know the fact that we come from colonial stock and that we were prisoners initially and criminals. But I think that that's kind of largely changed, and we're more kind of accepting of that these days. But I was actually approached by the director to write this screenplay because he couldn't manage to get he wanted to make an Australian Western, just couldn't manage to get a script that he liked or that was Australian enough, actually. But I was just very interested in writing a script anyway, just to see if I could do that. And I was lucky enough to be presented with the idea by John Hillcoat about something that I knew a little bit about.
If you don't mind my bringing this up, your father was killed by a car accident when you were 19.
Yeah.
I'm wondering what it did to your sense of justice, of there being a God in this world, of your sense of vulnerability and impermanence, to have something like that happen when you were relatively young.
Well, I think it had a huge impact. You know, my world became decidedly different almost overnight. It changed from being a relatively safe world to being a very unsure place. And I pretty much left, you know, I lived at home with my mother, but I pretty much left home after that and went what we Australians say is as overseas, which is to England.
Did it push you into adulthood and independence sooner?
Well, you know, I wasn't a child. I was 19. No, I don't think it did that. But I certainly kind of took off running in some way. You know, I mean, there was an urgency after that creatively that I didn't have before that. And I'm not really sure what that's to do with. But, you know, and a kind of rage about things, you know.
He had been an English teacher. Was he an influence on you in terms of writing or the books that you read?
I mean, he was a massive influence. You know, he was a smart guy and a very well read. And, you know, and I'd be sitting around at home and reading something or other, and he would say, you know, I'd be reading a crime novel, let's say, and he'd say, well, look, if you really want to read a great murder scene, here, check this out. And he'd kind of read the murder scene in Crime and Punishment to me. Or, you know, he read me the first chapter of Lolita, which had a huge impact over me. I mean, for many reasons. Not just in that he turned me on to a lot of great literature, but I kind of saw the effect that literature had on him and, you know, and kind of wanted some of that.
And your mother was a librarian. Did she choose books for you?
Well, not in the same way. But really, even though my father was very much the flamboyant one, and the one the family would kind of crane towards when he would be talking at the dinner table, I'm very much like my mother, actually. Most of my ideals and stuff really come from my mother.
Did you read the Bible with either of your parents, since they knew a lot about books and you talked about reading the Bible when you were young?
No. No, they weren't particularly religious.
I thought they might be into it, like, as literature.
No, you know, I think after a while I started to look for things that my parents didn't know about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I became very competitive with my father, particularly as a teenager, and actively went out and kind of started to look at areas of literature that I knew that he didn't really know much about.
Like what?
Like French literature. You know, I mean, I remember poring over Alfred Jarry and stuff like that and going back to him and saying, hey, have you read Alfred Jarry? And he going, well, no, I haven't, you know. And I'm going, well, you should, Dad, you know. So, you know, that we became quite competitive later on, you know, as we should.
You know, we've talked a lot about your early life and your formative years. Tell us a little bit about what your life is like now. I know you're married, you have... two children. You have a couple of children from earlier relationships.
Yeah, I have
two.
Four children.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What's my life like? I don't know. My life. I work a lot. I seem to have an enormous amount of projects on the go. All sorts of different things. And it's a very exciting time at the moment. You know, I'm about to make another Grinderman record and go on a major tour with the Dig Lazarus Dig record by the Bad Seeds. I've got a couple of soundtracks pending, and I'm working on a new novel. So there's a lot of stuff happening, and it just feels like a good time in that respect.
Do you feel like when you were younger, you were into a kind of intentionally, like, transgressive image, and that as you've gotten older, that's just kind of changed, and the way you live life has changed?
Yeah, the way I live life has changed. I don't think I particularly had any kind of image. I was just the way that I was and interested in the things that I was at that particular time. I don't feel that there's much of a logic to the kind of trajectory of my life. It's just gone the way it has. At the moment, it feels strong. It feels strong, and that's a really nice feeling to have, especially creatively.
I don't know if you've read your entry on Wikipedia.
No.
If you don't mind, I'm going to quote something that I think is really hysterical. Nick Cave has a reputation, which he disowns, for singing dark, brooding songs, which some listeners regard as depressing. I just think that's so funny. I mean, the darkness of your songs is so rich, and I think it's wonderful when pop music or, you know, rock music or whatever you want to call your music can have the depth and darkness that your songs do. And to think, like, which some listeners regard as depressing, really, I just think it's really funny. Do people?
Well, you know, it worries me. That's always worried me. And it's something that you're going to get if you make certain types of music. But the thought that my music depresses people, you know, is horrifying. I would hate my music to depress people. Unless there were certain types of people that I would like to see depressed.
Who would you like to see depressed by
your
songs?
Well, people who find my music depressing.
There, they deserve it then.
Whoever wrote that Wikipedia entry, actually. But you know, I mean, that's not what the creative process. It's a positive thing to me. I don't write when I'm depressed. If I'm depressed, which is actually rare, I'm not doing anything, you know, and I'm not able to do anything. You know, there might be some melancholic songs in there, but you can't write something unless you can't. This sort of spirit takes you, you know, and that's a positive and optimistic thing in my view.
Nick Cave, he has a new CD with his band, The Bad Seeds. It's called Dig Lazarus Dig. Here's another track from it called Today's Lesson. Although Japanese animation has been coming to America for years, it's exploded in the digital age. One of its hits here is a TV series called Death Note, which plays on the Cartoon Network. Volume 4 comes out on DVD this week. Critic at large John Power says, if you haven't seen the earlier episodes, it's worth taking the time to catch up.
A few weeks ago, I was having dinner with a Tokyo film producer who told me that the best thing to come from Japan in the last few years wasn't a movie. It was an animated TV series called Death Note. I decided to check it out and instantly discovered that, as usual, the teenagers had gotten there way before me. It turns out that Death Note, based on a Japanese comic book or manga, is a worldwide phenomenon, a cult whose members extend from Tokyo to Tasmania to Texas. The English language version of the manga is already in its sixth printing. The TV series has been showing on the Cartoon Network, and the whole thing is being rolled out on DVD. In the process, it's created a fan base, including many of my friends' kids, that is, well, obsessed. Not only do international websites hum with passionate discussions of the story's characters, there are now Death Note notebooks, Death Note backpacks, Death Note necklaces, and because it's a series for fanatics, there's even a book on how to read Death Note. The reason for its popularity is simple. Death Note has an almost infinitely seductive premise. A bored high school senior gets his hands on a notebook with a strange power. If you write someone's name in it, that person will die. The student's name is Light Yagami, a brilliant young man who feels superior to those around him. Vain but never petty, Light decides to use the notebook's power to eliminate evil. Casting himself as both judge and jury, he starts killing off criminals in hopes of creating a new world and, not incidentally, turning himself into a kind of god. The police soon realize that there's a special kind of killer out there, They call him Kira. To track him down, they enlist the help of the world's greatest detective. He's known simply as L, a boyish, long-haired misfit who always sits clutching his knees. L and Light begin a dizzying cat-and-mouse game that eventually involves Light's policeman father, L's sidekicks, M and N, a ditzy pop idol named Misa, various crooked businessmen, and of course, the run-amuck media. Here, early on, Light slash Kira discovers from the internet that most people secretly support his murder of the criminals. And he reflects on what this means.
Although this would probably never happen in school, let's say that students were asked to discuss whether bad people deserve to die. Well, you can bet that everyone would give the politically correct answer.
It's just wrong to kill people.
That's what they're bound to say. Of course, that's the correct response to give, right? Humans will always try to maintain appearances when they're in public. That's just how we are. But this is how they really feel. Most are too afraid to support me as they're worried about what others will think. Many would rather deny my existence. But on the internet, where you can remain anonymous, support for Kira is growing. Maybe people are afraid to say it out loud, but they all understand what's happening. Someone's making the bad guys disappear one by one. Those who have done no wrong are cheering for Kira in their hearts because they have nothing to fear, while those who have done wrong are on the run. They're forced to hide from an unknown enemy. This is how it should be. It's perfect. Everything is going just like I planned.
Death Note was created by Sugumi Oba and Takeshi Obata, who have a real knack for capturing the adolescent psyche. For starters, the battle between Light and L is the struggle between two models of teenagers. Light is the socially adept overachiever. He gets good grades, wins at tennis, and snags lots of chicks. He believes he can bend the world to his will. In contrast, L is something of a nerd. The Japanese term is otaku, an obsessive outsider who doesn't fit into the world. Both he and Light quickly grasp that they are actually doppelgangers, two lonely souls who should be best friends. Instead, they're deadly enemies. And because each of them feels that he truly represents justice, they both actually embody a familiar, slightly comical teenage arrogance. If only I ran the world, not those mediocre fools, things would be a whole lot better. Although it's filled with ideas about conformity and the ends justifying the means, Death Note is not exactly Dostoevskian in its exploration of good and evil. But it is a wonderful piece of pop storytelling that's at least as addictive as a show like Lost. It's filled with brilliant twists, cliffhanger endings, and schemes within schemes within schemes. When my wife and I first began watching, we didn't know how long the series ran, and at episode 10, we were raving at how skillfully the show was building to its climax. Oops. We discovered there were still 27 more half-hour episodes, nearly all of them riveting. But the show's appeal goes beyond the fact that it's enormously entertaining. For the brainy kids who like it, and it is a series for brainy kids, Death Note offers a tantalizing variation on the idea that underlies Harry Potter and The Matrix. It's all about a young chosen one possessed of awesome power who wants to wipe out evil. But unlike Harry or Neo in The Matrix, Light Yagami is an anti-hero, a rebel with a cause that's misguided. Even as we identify with his desire to make a better world, we see that he's led astray by his lack of experience and of mentors. There's no Dumbledore to be found. Light may want to be a god, but in fact, for all his intelligence, he's still only a teenager.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. He reviewed the Japanese TV series Death Note, shown on the Cartoon Network's Late Night Adult Swim block. Volume 4 comes out tomorrow. I'm Terry Gross, and we'll close with music by the composer, saxophonist, and clarinet player Jimmy Giuffre. He died Thursday, 2 days before his 87th birthday. He was best known for writing Four Brothers for the Woody Herman Band and for leading his own small groups. Here he is playing his most famous composition, The Train and the River. Thank you.